Blog Talk Radio.
The Rebecca Roth Show, where the light shines out of the darkness onto the elephant in the room.
I can't believe a week has come and gone. It's another Saturday. Good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be. You're listening to the Rebecca Roth Show. I'm your host, Graham Jett. And I have to tell you, this week went by very quickly, and I think I know why. Typically, on the Rebecca Roth Show, I usually have some kind of a rant that I get off. But I got out-ranted last week, and Rebecca's rant just went viral. In fact, the other night, I was having a hard time sleeping, and I woke up, got online, and I heard people slapping themselves because they were stupid all over the country. So who knows what we're going to get into this week. So let me present to you Miss Roth.
The Rebecca Roth Show, where the light shines out of the darkness onto the elephant in the room.
Fasten your seatbelts. The foremost authority on 9/11, the best-selling author of Methodical Illusion, and a researcher extraordinaire, Rebecca Roth is about to step up to the microphone and launch into Reality Check, where the light will shine brightly upon the truth.
Well, now that we've got Jim Fetzer's blood pressure up, I'm sure he just absolutely hates that, as well as some of the other trolls that that were 10 years old on 9/11 and now they think they're an expert. Well, welcome to the Rebecca Roth Show. I can tell my listening to my own self through my headsets. I still sound like I have a cold. Sorry about that. Today's going to be a really interesting show. We're going to talk about the hijacking protocols that were in place on 9/11. And I know that some of you have heard me on Caravan to Midnight or Coast to Coast AM or some other radio show, and I've talked about this. And sometimes, you know, when stuff becomes second nature to you, it's kind of like breathing. So it's hard to explain, you know, how it is to walk and chew gum or breathe, do things that you don't, you know, have to think much about. And that's kind of how hijacking protocols became after 31 years of training over and over and over again, which is one reason why I wanted to stress that in the Methodical Illusion. It's something that we did every year. And in place at the time of 9/11 was an FAA protocol for hijacking, and it was referred to by title called Common Strategy. And so it was our common strategy. Every flight attendant for any United States air carrier, practiced, studied, and drilled every year in their yearly recurring training exactly what to do and how to do it. Now, the reason we were working in conjunction with the pilots and the FAA was that we were there, are actually still are. If you're still flying, you are the eyes and the ears of the pilots. Because as most of you know, there's a cockpit door. Post 9/11, that cockpit door is now grenade-proof and bulletproof and locked twice. And there's usually electric keypad off to one side, and then there's a locking mechanism too. So it's kind of a double trick to get into the cockpit. And it was really frustrating for us having to carry trays of food when we needed to feed the pilots and stuff, and then do all this machinations with these unlocking devices to get in. When I first started flying in 1973, I know that ages me, but y'all know I'm old. I know, and I don't care if you don't like my hair or my glasses and I'm my age. I'm old. So what? In 1973, one of my main things that I was issued, besides my FAA-required carry flashlight and manual, was a cockpit key. Now, I know there's some trolls out there that like to say that I said the doors weren't locked. But why would they give me a key in 1973? if the doors weren't locked. So let me just stress this so that Daniel Pleasy and all those crazy trolls that would like to go out and misquote me, Fetzer included, the doors were locked in 1973. That's why one of my must-have items when I would check in for a flight was a cockpit key, a Boeing cockpit key. Yes, indeed, it was, because the doors were locked. Now,
I noticed, too, that nowadays, you know, they lock the doors almost immediately when they're ready to push back. But a lot of times that door didn't get locked until they were, you know, on the runway ready to throttle back.
Years ago, prior to back in
73.
Well, that's true.
I remember sitting mm-hmm. up mm-hmm. front, and you could, you know, see the pilots, and they were doing whatever they were doing, trying mm-hmm. to taxi the plane up to the runway. And so, it wasn't that big a deal.
When I first started flying, we would push back from the gate, and we would actually talk to the pilots and tell them this cabin is secure, and the door was open and we were taxiing. So and that all changed with over time. And one of the things I want to kind of talk about today is some of the things that happened that changed things. I was telling Ramjet early on, we were just reminiscing about how it used to be to fly. Our kids don't even know this, but when I first started flying in 1973, I would check in at a hangar. That's how, when I heard those flight attendants say, and Betty Ong said that. Now, I've had arguments about that, but you have to understand that is only in the initial FBI interview. It's been removed from some of them. That's why it caught my eye. Because when she said he stood upstairs, I knew there were no stairs on that aircraft. So that, again, has become a troll hiccup. They can't handle it. But it is, in fact, in the initial FBI interviews from 9/11/2001. She said he stood upstairs. Well, since I first started flying, and our offices were up inside a 747 hangar, we would go upstairs. Hey, we went upstairs. Imagine that, hangar upstairs. And we would sign in to our office, and there would check to make sure that we had our cockpit key, our flashlight, our manuals, and all of those things that the company required or the FAA required. These are two different items. Company might require you to have an apron to serve a meal, but the FAA doesn't care. They did require you to have a flashlight, because if you crash at night, you are going to get people out by using your flashlight. So we actually had FAA-approved flashlights that were mandatory to have with us. And we had to show someone in the office that we had these items before we could go to work. So it's kind of hard to imagine, but that's what it was.
And you also had to keep to your weight.
Yeah, well, when I first started flying, we're going to age me. When I first started flying, we had to get on a scale and weigh ourselves, and we were in a height and weight chart that was just a standard chart you probably find in any magazine or diet book of the early 70s or late 60s. And you could not go 1 pound over your required weight without being put on restriction or kind of given a warning. And every time you come to work, you'd have to get on the scale.
So if you felt like you were a bit overweight on a particular flight, would you put lifters in your shoes? Your height would be
taller. Well, they charted your, they knew exactly how high you were, and you're not going to stretch out. So also, just to date me, we had to wear false eyelashes and girdles. So when we went to work, my first initial uniform was 9 inches above my kneecap.
I don't think the younger generation even knows what a girdle is.
I'm sure they don't. Times were different then. A lot different, actually. So what we would do is we would sign out, show that we have all of our stuff and sign out on our flights. And then together as a crew, we would do a briefing and figure out where we were going to work inside the airplane. We're going to talk about this workstation again. In our next show, we're going to talk about all those phone calls. And so what that workstation is like, I'm going to work the back galley, or I'm going to work first class, or I'm going to be the purser. And so together as a group, we would walk through the hangar. This is now 73, through the hangar, across the tarmac. And it's hard for people to believe now. Flight attendants would flip over. We would walk through the hangar and then across the tarmac. And sometimes we'd have to wait for aircraft to go and plug our ears because it's really loud. And then we would walk up the jetway stairs into the working aircraft we were on. We'd know that was at gate such and such. And just so you know, when you're down on the ramp, on the tarmac, you can see what jetway number that is. They have big numbers on them, so you can see on the outside. So the baggage claim people, if they're running out to, you know, gate B26, it says right there on the jetway. And so they know exactly where B26 is, so they put the stuff on the right aircraft and that sort of thing. So we would know what gate our aircraft was waiting for us, and then we would go up the stairs. And guess what that meant? We never, ever walked in front of any kind of security at all. I know, not at all. It's really changed after 9/11. They were squeezing out our toothpaste.
Well, let me just give you a little perspective from the passenger side of this. You know, I've told this story before on the air about, you know, going up to us in the late 60s, early 70s, going up to San Francisco and getting on a 747 without permission, just basically going on and going on board, going in the cockpit. Nobody cared. It was no big deal. And I, you know, I tell my kids this and they think I'm absolutely out of my mind. But from a flight perspective, all you needed was a ticket. You know, there was no security back in the 70s. It didn't even have to have your name on it. You know, your mother could have said, you know, hey, I got this ticket that I didn't use to Los Angeles. Let me give it to you and you can fly. And they were perfectly fine with that. You didn't have to show ID. It didn't matter who you were. And as late as 1983, when America West started flying out of Phoenix, I happened to be in Phoenix at the time, they started with 3 737s. And you didn't even have to have a ticket. You could just go to the gate, get on board, and you could buy your ticket on the airplane. The flight attendants would come by with their little, credit card swiper, and you'd put your credit card in there, and they'd put all the deals in there, and they'd swipe it, and then you'd sign it, and you'd have your ticket. That didn't last very long because I think there were some other inherent problems with it, like people that didn't have credit cards.
But they do that after pushback?
Pushback. You do it in the air.
That could be problematic. I can see that.
They started in 83. They probably did that for a year before they, you know, throttled back to having to have an actual ticket. But, you know, it's pretty nice not having to have to go through any kind of security.
Well, you have a story, too, from being with a Boy Scout troop or something. You went into a 747, didn't you?
Well, I just mentioned that. You know, friend of mine and I. The 747 had just come out, and we wanted to see it. So we drove up to San Francisco, got on the plane, and walked all the way through it, asked people questions. Nobody cared that we were there.
I remember we used to have tours, kindergarten kids and third graders, and we'd be getting ready to go to Tokyo or something, and the agent would come on and say, I've got a tour of kids, and they'd come and run up the spiral stairs and go check out the cockpit and go all over. Well, times have really, really changed, and so one of the things that what happened to me, what allowed me really to start to see that 9/11 wasn't a hijacking at all. Not only nobody did what they were supposed to. So when we're talking about these protocols, the common strategy basically was a system that was set in place since the 1960s. And it was really using all of the hijackings. And up until, D.B. Cooper, 1970, 71, I forget for sure, but we'll go over that. D.B. Cooper hijacked a 727 out of Portland, Oregon, going to Seattle, Tacoma. And if you'll remember, the 727 had an aft stairs that came down. He obviously had been in the military and knew how to parachute jump, and not too far from Seattle, Tacoma Airport, about 20 miles, was a sport. A parachute jumping field where they would, on the weekends or any given good weather afternoon, a little airplane would go up with maybe 10 or so guys to parachute jump. So he knew that was there too. I'm not sure how he did, but he did know that was there. And so he demanded, I think, either two or four, parachutes. Why two? Or four?
Four parachutes.
$200,000. $200,000. Four parachutes. Why four parachutes? Because he wanted to make sure every single one of them was packed to open. Now, if he would have just asked for one, we could have had that thing packed so it didn't open, right? So he was a pretty smart guy. But he parachuted.
Actually, this strategy was brilliant. everything was brilliant about this whole thing, except for the fact that he jumped out of an airplane over Washington in the middle of winter.
Yeah, between Washington and Oregon, I guess, is where he, kind of that Mount St. Helens area, really. Years ago, I read an interesting book that was supposed to have been written by the woman that he stumbled into her chicken coop or something, one of her barn outbuildings, and she found him, and he had a broken ankle or something. It was very fascinating. According to that book, he died of a heart attack at Newark International. I don't know if that's true or not, because really, he got away with this. Nobody's ever found him, D.B. Cooper, and it's a very interesting story. So if you're, you know, do a Google search on it, it's a kind of a fascinating thing. But one of the things that happened for the United States and the FAA, the Federal Aviation Agency or Administration, I guess it is that through all of these hijackings, which believe it or not, the first one started in 1929. That's hard to believe, isn't it? It was in the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, they wrote this story about this guy who tried to hijack a plane. And then in 1931, there was a hijacking also outside of Peru. 1939, and it's hard to imagine. It's so far back. I mean, you think of Wilburn, right? You know, kind of thing. But the hijackings that took place were really mostly, in our minds, I guess, if you're old enough to remember when they really started in the 60s. And usually the hijacker wanted to go to Cuba. Now, looking back in retrospect and knowing more, and since some people have, had some deathbed confessions and that sort of thing, we now know that most of those hijackers really were CIA agents. And a lot of that was done to make Castro look bad. Just kind of, you know, the Bay of Pigs, all of that stuff that was going on in the 60s. So we had some, hijackings that took place, most of them in the early 60s. 62 was, one of the first ones in the United States wanted to go to Cuba, National Airlines. It was a Convair 440. And then again, we had an interesting one. Now, I have actually a whole little story about this, but this is really fascinating. In July of 1961, it was the first attempted skyjacking, that's how they were called at the time, skyjacking of an American airliner on American soil. And it's really interesting. It was done by a guy named Bruce Britt Sr. He boarded and attempted to commandeer a Pacific Airlines flight at the Chico Municipal Airport in Chico, California. And he intended to return to, believe it or not, Smackover, Arkansas, his hometown. And his attempt failed, but he actually ended up shooting two airline employees. And that was in 1962. And then we didn't really have anything else going on until like 1968. TWA was involved in a hijacking. And let's see where they wanted to go. Someplace, let's see, TWA Flight 85 from Los Angeles. San Francisco was hijacked by a 19-year-old U.S. Marine. Oh, those U.S. Marines. They've just gotten themselves in trouble up there in Oregon lately, too. So anyway, that was just another attempt. It didn't work very successfully, and the guy ended up spending a couple of years in prison.
Well, that's really the thing to note about all this, is that most of these hijackings that occurred in the 60s and 70s really weren't very successful. I mean, if they did end up in Cuba, for example, the plane came back and they always proclaimed that the hijacker was arrested and put in some Cuban jail, but you never really knew what happened to him. But the point is this is what started finally the security aspect, where you had to go through some kind of magnetometer to make sure you didn't have a gun, and then you could get on board. And it was obnoxious at first, but it wasn't that obnoxious compared to today's
standards. Yeah, as a matter of fact, it was that Pacific Airlines event that caused the cockpit doors to always be locked. And that started a process through the FAA. It took a while once that that happened, but in about 1964 or so, the FAA had mandated that the cockpit door needed to be locked. Now, all the airlines kind of had a different ruling for exactly what moment. Was it pushback or once the cabin was secure? Because once we start taking off, you know, I know that people don't really understand this, but we walk through the cabin, excuse me, making sure that the aisleway at your feet is clear of all your carry-on so that you and everyone else in your aisle can get out if we need to evacuate the aircraft on the runway, and that your seatbelt is fastened. And so we do that. So our final walkthrough, and after that's done, we have to tell the pilot the cabin is secured. And so there was a time where the door was still open. You could do that. And then after that, you would have to phone them because the door was shut. And, of course, the door has been locked since 1964. Now, like I said, I started in 73, and I was given a key because the door was locked. So that's just the way it is. I know there's some people that like to say that I'm out there saying the doors were never locked, but I had a key in 1973, so I know they were locked by then. November 24th, 1971, right before I started flying, a man named D.B. Cooper, he hijacked a Northwest Orient Airlines flight number 305, and it was Boeing 727-100 series. That was a shorter aircraft between Portland and Seattle. And so that's kind of one of the big ones. And Braniff actually got hijacked, Braniff Flight 385. Another 727 hijacked out of Houston, Texas, bound for Dallas. And somebody else, they wanted $2 million in parachutes. Let's see. I believe that one, the law enforcement stormed the aircraft. I guess it hadn't taken off yet. See, here's the thing I've often said too. Hijackings only take place on the ground. And I think this guy, if I remember correctly, tried to do this when they were still in the air. And still on the ground, or else they landed. And then once you're on the ground, and that was the name of the game, the common strategy was to get the airplane on the ground where we could deal with the hijacker, deal with him, not us, but, the SWAT team or the FBI or whoever the hijack rescue people were at wherever you ended up landing. So that's ended up what happened to him as he kind of got taken out. But again, in 1972, TWA was hijacked. So you see what happened is the FAA put together this common strategy, and it was basically how we could step by step, first off, inform the pilots there's a hijacker. Now, because we are the eyes and the ears of the pilots, they don't know what's going on in the cabin. And, of course, the hijacker would be in the cabin, not in the cockpit. So if a hijacker would come up to me as a flight attendant with a weapon or a note or something, he wanted to take the airplane to, let's just say Cuba, because that was so common, then I would do several things. One, I would let him think I was doing that. I was going to help him get there by not being aggressive against him, but saying, yes, well, let me see what we can do to help you, sir. And so I would go then to the interphone, which calls the cockpit and the other flight attendant bases on the plane, and I would call the captain, and I would say to the captain, now, keep in mind, this is no longer the protocol. After 9/11, it all changed. So I would say to the captain in a very formal manner, Captain Johnson, sir, which I wouldn't normally do. I'd just say, hey, Dick, what do you guys want to eat? But I would say, Captain Johnson, sir, and this is Miss Rebecca Roth. And I would use a code word and tell him that I was being that code word. And in that, he would turn around, and on his computer between himself and the co-pilot, they would do what's called squawking 7500. They would just put in the 7500 frequency into the radio. That right there would tell air traffic control, other airplanes, everyone in the vicinity that we were under a hijacking. At that point, the flight attendants, the rest of them, if they realized what was going on, should kind of sit down and not draw attention to themselves. Sometimes, you know, you'd want to put a blanket over your uniform or take your jacket or your wings off, you know, or throw somebody's coat on that's up in the overhead bin, and allow just that one flight attendant, if you could, to deal with the hijacker. And so if he wanted something, you could say, oh, I don't have any of that in the first class galley, so come on back to the back with me and let me look. And he'd like, all of a sudden, you're the only one. And so it's you and him working together. And the name of the game was delay until we could get the airplane on the ground.
Now, under a scenario like that, where you're back in the cabin with the hijacker delaying him, what is the pilot doing at that point? If he's already squawked 7,500, is he looking to immediately to land?
Yes. And so he's coordinating with the company, air traffic controllers, where we can land the aircraft and coordinate it with some sort of hostage rescue, SWAT team, FBI, whoever is the nearest city that you can get that kind of help. You may not find this at Billings, Montana, or, you know, a smaller station like that. But so it'll all be coordinated. And here's another thing interesting. The flight attendants would be communicating with only the pilots. We never, ever do. Here's what happened to me with the 9/11 story. The flight attendants only, Betty Ong only is the only one that said, we can't communicate with the pilots. We can't talk. They're not answering their phone. So how can you coordinate your checking if you can't talk to the people who are going to be talking? Because the pilots have radio contact with everybody on the ground and air traffic control, and they've got telephones, and everyone connects that way. So all of the information, and this is why in hijack training we were taught how to recognize the three components of a bomb. We were recognized how to tell, we're taught how to recognize, weapons, guns, different things like that, so that we could tell the pilots the hijacker has a 9mm handgun or a box cutter or whatever the weapon was. He has a bomb, and I see the initiator. I can see the wires. I can see blah, 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 and describe that. And so now on 9/11, none of that was happening because only on Flight 11 did Betty Ong say she couldn't talk to the pilots. But on Flight 93, two flight attendants called out of that flight, Cece Lyles and a gal named, her last name was Sandy Bradshaw. Now, Sandy Bradshaw called her husband, and he was a U.S. Air pilot, I believe, U.S. Air, U.S. Airways. And, have you heard what's happening? We've been hijacked. She's like a cheerleader. That is not what you would do. First off, it's really nearly impossible to make a phone call. And I have a person that's very much in the know of how things work, especially on American Airlines, that has just told me that if Betty Ong was sitting at door 3R, like she kept saying, and that's her workstation in the middle of the aircraft, aft of the aircraft, 3R, that airplane, it was a lot after all, that the air phone would not reach to her jump seat. Now, that's coming from someone that should know. I didn't fly for American, but my friend did. So obviously that means she would have had to been calling on a cell phone. We know that she was calling on a cell phone for 27 minutes from an altitude of 30,000 feet or so. It's impossible. So these are the things that I started to see. On Flight 93, keep in mind, now this plane, it left 40 minutes late, but the flight attendants, two of which, one had been a police officer. You would think after 6 years as a police officer, you'd know how to follow directions. And you would do the right thing in hijacking. She called her husband twice. Now, if you could place a phone call, there are phone numbers, I've talked about this before, to crew scheduling or to our security offices or crew scheduling. So that number is emblazed in your memory. So you would call them and they can connect you right now, boom, to the security people. So everything you're saying of what there's a weapon or they have this or they want to go here, what their demands are, what's the situation, how many are there, what's going on, would all be conveyed all at once to the military, the FAA, to the company security people. The last place you would call would be your home and your spouse And so two very senior flight attendants that should have known better, not very senior. I mean, Cece Lyles hadn't flown that long. Met, I think Sandy Bradshaw had 13 years. That's a lot of seniority for a flight attendant. You've been through 13 years of training over and over and over again. This did not change really since the 70s. All the code words were the same. The protocol was the same. The step-by-steps were the same. What you would do, what the pilots would do, what the name of the game was, get the plane on the ground. Now, also on Flight 77, a flight attendant did call out from there. She was Renee May, I believe was her name. And she called her mom and dad in Las Vegas. Now, what good would your parents do? And they have no idea where you're at. You're calling from this. Again, wrong. And so these were the things that I saw. One, you wouldn't be talking to anybody but the pilots. And now let's just say, for instance, you could make a phone call. I don't care if it's the air phone or if it's a cell phone and you were at an altitude and miracles could happen and the connection would take place. I don't know. It'd have to be a miracle. Let's just say you're using an air phone. You would not call your husband or your parents, period, ever. No flight attendant would do that. I know they're listening. So I know, you know, that you would never do that. First off, your mom and dad never know what the heck where you're at. They never know, and they don't know the procedure, and they wouldn't even know a phone call to call. But crew scheduling, now they would. They would just push a button and connect you with the Security Operations Center, SOC, sometimes they are referred to. And so, you see, when I started to see that the FAA protocols were not followed, I was like, uh-oh, there's something wrong with the hijack scenario. And then again, I found out that United and American also had bought into the flight termination system or the remote control system that was sold to the airlines in the late 80s, early 90s. In the event of a hijacking, we can take control of the aircraft remotely and land the airplane. If the hijacker is in the cockpit. Now, why did that happen? We had, according to the official story, four aircraft that had been commandeered. And the most important thing that all of the flight attendants that called out, every one of them, there were two on Flight 11, there was one on Flight 77, and there were two on United 93. The most important thing for them to say was this, because this is how the FAA worked. How did someone get into the cockpit? Did they break the door down? Did they have a key? Did they kill the senior flight attendant and find which pocket she kept her key in? How did they get into the cockpit? Not one of them said that. And so when I saw that again, I went, again, you have a question for me.
Well, I know I've heard you mention the fact that these flight termination systems, they shut down all communication on the aircraft. Mm-hmm. Why was that? What was the thinking behind that? I mean, what you were saying is that the flight attendants couldn't communicate with the pilot. The pilot couldn't communicate with anybody. All of those communication devices that he has in the cockpit, you know, just go dead. Why was the termination system designed to do that?
I'm not sure, to tell you the truth. I am not sure why.
I think in my mind, it would make the most sense is if somebody was going to take over control of a plane using the flight termination system to land it, you wouldn't want to have any interference at all from anybody. Mm-hmm. And the hijacker couldn't communicate with anybody.
Anyone. Yeah.
And
that's
I think
true.
That maybe that was the reasoning behind
that's
that.
True. Yeah. Well, that's a good point. It's interesting because you remember the flight termination system is a system, and I believe it's still in effect. It's the system how we control our drones from Creech Air Force Base and various other Air Force bases where we have these little command centers where the pilots can actually fly the drones while they're in Pakistan or Yemen or Afghanistan or someplace like that. So let's see. I have some questions that some people asked me on my Facebook page. And here's one question they asked is, why has there been no hijacking since 9/11? Actually, hadn't been any hijackings in the United States since D.B. Cooper.
It's probably because we can only bring 1 ounce of liquid.
I'm sure that has a lot to do with it. Actually, there was a couple incidences after D.B. Cooper. And one of them we were talking about earlier was the... it was a really sad. It was in 1987, and this was not so much a hijacking as it was a disgruntled employee. And that was Pacific Southwest Airlines, and it actually became part of U.S. Airways, which is now part of American. And a disgruntled employee. But this is an interesting story. And I was going over this not too long ago. We were talking about this, and for like a month or so, two maybe ago, I was talking about this because there's something very interesting about this. This is a guy who was actually a black man. He was an employee, and he was from Jamaica, actually. And he had been living in Britain growing up, and then he moved to New York and became a PSA employee. And he'd been fired. So he gets on the airplane with a 44 Magnum. Remember the story? And he shoots the pilots and shot the flight attendants. This thing crashed.
But most importantly, he shot his ex-boss.
Yeah, he shot his ex-boss, who was a passenger. And what's really, really weird about this is it was a small aircraft. Let's see what it was. It was something I never flew. It was a four-engine British aerospace aircraft is what that was. And in the cockpit voice recorder, they found all this stuff. But this airplane left, was relatively small aircraft. It left 27 passengers, however, so not that small, but you know how those kind of commuters are. It left a hole, and it literally, when it hit the ground at about a 70-degree angle, crashing down, it left a hole. And it caught on fire, boom, exploded, obviously. But miraculously enough, they found a paper barf bag with a note from this character. His name was David Burke, who's the perpetrator of the crime. And on that barf bag, he had written a note kind of explaining why he hated his boss and that he'd done this. And there was no bodies ever found on this one because they were obviously burnt and stuff. But they did find a fingertip hooked to part of the gun that was like the trigger part. And they fingerprinted that guy. And that's how they actually ended up blaming him. So it's just about as goofy a story as 9/11. But after that, that was in 1987. And then at that point, all the flight crews then had to go through security. I think he's the one who, if I remember correctly, it was that incident that really changed security for a lot of us.
But even then, if you remember back in the late 80s, early 90s, when you'd go through security, you'd have to answer those idiotic questions. Did you pack your own bags? Have you left your bags anywhere where you couldn't see them? And you know, and you think, okay, if I was a hijacker, I'd probably lie here. I'd probably say...
If I remember correctly, those questions were in place on 9/11.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah.
That was what was going on. And it was just absolutely insane. And so then you'd go through the magnetometer and leave your keys in the cup. And because I've done that a few times myself. And but other than that, you know, it wasn't a problem. And you could still, even then, you could still have people come to greet you at the gate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weren't, you know, kept out in the outer, what they now call the secure area or the non-secure area. You know, you could have people come and greet you. And even prior to that, we were talking earlier about you could sometimes, like if you were taking your aged mother, you could actually wheel her on board.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, tuck her in and fasten her seatbelt and give her a kiss goodbye and then leave.
And that went on for a long time. I mean, that where you could take your children if they were unaccompanied. I mean, I remember most of my career where parents would come on with our maybe a 12-year-old that was going to go spend the summer with their dad or with, you know, go to their grandparents' ranch or something. And you could chit chat with the mother and then she would leave and then we'd board the regular passengers.
Well, you know, and then it changed. And I remember, you know, my dad on his last flight, because he was a regular passenger, on his last flight, they wanted family members to come into the secure area to greet him. And it was absolutely the most hellacious thing trying to get security to allow.
Was it post 9/11?
It was post 9/11.
Okay. Yeah, that made it really tough.
And, you know, and all we were going to do was be there to congratulate him on his last flight. no big deal. I mean, they searched us, they patted us down. We had to sign practically depositions that blah, blah, blah. I mean, you'd have thought that the world was slowly coming to an end in order for us to get into the secure area. And there were only like five of us. I mean, it wasn't,
Well, after 9/11, everybody was a terrorist. And the government started looking at you. It doesn't matter if you were 85, 95 in a wheelchair. I remember hearing just horror stories of elderly people that couldn't even stand up, that were just absolutely ripped apart for having a lipstick tube, a metal tube of lipstick in their pocket. And they didn't even know what was going on. Maybe they were, a bit senile or something. And their adult kids would get on the plane and say, "Oh my God, we just had a nightmare experience at the security." And that they beat up on old ladies and really young kids, and including infants that couldn't walk or talk. So they're not going to hijack an aircraft. But the TSA doesn't use any sense at all. And so I know you have something to add to that.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, if you really wanted to hijack an aircraft, we're not going to go into ways in which you can do that. But trust me, there are ways you could go about doing that. So the answer to the question, why haven't there been any hijackings since 9/11? Well, there weren't any hijackings on 9/11.
Well, that's true. That's a great answer, too. And so what we had on 9/11 wasn't. And that's how I got to see, when I started to see these flight attendants doing exactly what, not only did they do something crazy, they did something we were told not to do. If you could make a phone call, let's just say you could, you would call a secure company line that would get you the help of, and when I mean help, I mean get you jets scrambled, the FAA involved, air traffic controllers involved, the company involved, the safety people involved, the negotiators from the FBI. There's a whole huge team of people that would be involved. No flight attendant in their right mind, not even an airhead flight attendant that's only concerned about her jewelry. There's a few of those. No one would not do what you're supposed to do in a hijacking. When I saw the flight attendants doing that, I was like, oh, there's a problem here. And so that's one of the things that really got me into looking at why were they not following hijack protocol, because it hadn't changed for a long time, 30 plus years.
Well, another aspect of this, and you mentioned this, about calling security and having Air Force jets on your wingtips within a matter of 5 or 6 minutes. The thing that's really interesting about that is, from a psychological standpoint, a hijacker has no idea what those Air Force jets are going to do. And if they can look out the window and they can see
neither do
guys,
we.
and the way that's
frightening.
You have no idea whether they're going to shoot you down or not.
It's frightening.
And so, it's a problem. And yet on 9/11, where
was Oh, yeah. And Force? You can count the time. An hour and a half, almost 2 hours, nothing happened. And so, again, when I started to look at the entire system didn't operate the way it was supposed to, including the flight attendants, that I started to see that, oh, my goodness. And now remember that when I started looking at 9/11, it wasn't until after Thomas Keene had written his book in 2006 where he said, and he was the chairman of the 9/11 Commission and the vice chair, what's his name, Lee Hamilton, that the FAA and the Pentagon had given them so many quote-unquote misstatements, in other words, they lied, so many misstatements that they were considering an investigation into the FAA and the Pentagon. Well, of course, I had to start looking at those two places because they should have, and they told us that in that statement. So I have another question. Somebody asked me, is the cockpit door locked or unlocked? Of course, we already covered that. It's been locked since I started flying, actually, since 64, I believe. Always locked as soon as it can be once the aircraft door is shut and in-flight duties permit you to do so. Now it's all changing with 9/11, but that's how it was. And they asked, what situation would a pilot unlock the door to get out and go to the bathroom? Go get something to eat, grab a cup of coffee. Every once in a while, a pilot...
crash axe with
them. Yeah, prior to 9/11, they'd go to the bathroom, so they would unlock the door and go out. But that door would be locked. once he shut the door. So he would unlock it, open the door, get out, and then he would check his, take his cockpit key and unlock it to go back in. So that's that. There were, you know, that's since I started flying in 73. So let's see. Another question I got from my Facebook page is, what ways did the FAA hijack protocols diverge from the established protocols after 9/11? And I can't tell you, because then I'd have to kill you. I mean, it's just like the code words that we used were a code word that nobody could talk about. We would never tell anybody in public how we would contact the pilots to let them know we were under a hijacking, because then the general public would know our code words. So I can't give you that answer. But after 9/11, and they, of course, obviously want us to believe that they used those airplanes as weapons of mass destruction. And again, if it's a hijacker and he wants to go somewhere, it's a different story than someone that's maybe got a bomb strapped to him, or in this case, they supposedly got in the cockpit, but we know they didn't. Let's see. Another question is, someone wanted to know. The reservation agent asked Betty Ong, she called in the reservations, something, of course, we would never do. No airline, not even an American Airlines flight attendant, right? That's how I'm getting this from. Would call reservations in a hijacking. Of course, she would call crew scheduling. Hello, hello, how many times do I have to say that? But she kept calling the reservations gal. She was talking to the reservations gal. She talked for 27 minutes, and she kept repeating that she was, when they asked her, where are you sitting? They thought she was a passenger. Why do you think they thought that? Because a flight attendant would never, ever, ever, ever call reservations in a hijacking. We would call crew scheduling or a secure number in the company that could get us attached to the FAA, our traffic control, the United States Air Force, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and stop the hijacking. I mean, that's just crazy. You would just never call reservations. So, again, whenever a flight attendant calls reservations or any company line, you would get, say, this is Rebecca Roth. My employee number is 876592. And maybe even your date of hire, because kind of everything goes on those numbers, your employee number, and sometimes your date of hire if you had time. But when the reservations person kept asking, she kept saying, I'm at 3R. And the reservations lady just like, there is no 3R. There's maybe 3 A, B, C, D, E, and F or something. It's 3 is in first class or business class. So she just couldn't understand. And it made for a lot of confusion that Betty Ong called reservation.
Well, let me see if I can make an analogy. For a flight attendant to call reservations in the middle of a hijacking would be like going to Walmart and going up to the clerk and trying to take out a mortgage.
Kind of. Yeah. I mean,
it doesn't make any sense. You were going to do. So I think I've been in that Walmart line when people were trying to take out a mortgage. There was a lot of confusion going on both sides of the aisle.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, there's a lot of confusion with the reservation agent because, of course, she was not part of the common strategy. I doubt that reservations agents were even taught what to do if a flight attendant called them, because we would never call home or reservations. It's like calling your vet. I mean, it's just crazy. Why would you do that? So anyway, that was a lot of confusion. And again, for me as a flight attendant for so many decades, I was like, wait a minute. Why would she say that? Your work positions bid on your seniority or your seniority and your preference. If you want to be the galley person and bid, let's say, 3 R's a galley position in the coach galley, more power to you. Normally, I worked first class. But there were times I worked the back galley as well. But then another thing that Betty Ong did, I'm going to go off track here. Another thing that Betty Ong did was at 18 minutes after departure, she's on the phone and she said, the pilots aren't answering their phone. Well, you're in what's called a sterile cockpit until the aircraft reaches 10,000 feet, which is, you know, probably close to 12, 15 minutes, depending upon your fuel load, your passenger load, the type of aircraft you're in. And I thought immediately, well, why would the 3R position be calling the cockpit anyway? because she wouldn't. She'd be busy loading up the meal carts because it's a morning flight and you want to feed the people right away because they've been up for hours without eating and, you know, going through security and all that jazz and driving, of course, through morning traffic to get to the airport. So I knew what her duties, and they didn't include talking to the cockpit. Unless the airplane had started a descent and she'd already pulled out those meal carts and they're unlocked in her galley because she knows that this airplane's landing, and that airplane was in fact landing or had already landed, actually. But there's no reason for the aft coach flight attendant to call in the cockpit and then for her to say that. So again, in a hijacking, we would communicate all of the information about the hijacker. And since she was on the phone to reservations or to someone in the company, the other girl called her in-flight supervisor, but both of those girls failed to tell us so that we could prevent it in the future how a hijacker got into the cockpit, because no hijacker was in the cockpit, really. But that would have been, if in real life there was a hijacker, they would have said, they knocked the cockpit door down, they rammed it with a card or they, you know, something. They came on board with a cockpit key. Who knows? I mean, there had to have been a way they got in there. But keep in mind, a 767 is about 160 feet from Betty Ong's 3R, where she was sitting, to the cockpit door. So unless Betty Ong, who was strapped in there for at least 15 minutes.
She's more than half a football field.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long distance. So the 767, I think it's 159 feet, if I remember correctly, in the aisle. So roughly 160 feet away from what's going on. So both of the flight attendants on that flight, Flight 11, were talking about something going on up front in the cockpit, in first class, maybe on the other side of one or two curtains. And so the information they were giving, it was just nothing. And again, it's just not what you do. And then so those flight attendants were telling different stories of who, where they were, where they were sitting, because the other gal said Betty Ong was sitting in the last row coach with her. So our next show, we're going to talk about all of the details from all of the phone calls. And remember, don't use YouTube as a resource for research, sorry, because the recordings have all been manipulated. So if you're out there and you're thinking, well, I can't find Betty Ong saying he stood upstairs, look for the FBI's original interview, and there you will find it. And it's online, so you can find it. And I think it's 110 pages on that particular file. I don't remember the file number. It's 15, 20 digits. I'm good with digits, but I'm not that good. And so let's see if I have any more questions here. Oh, here's another great question. I have to ask this because it's so good. What orders was Cheney referring to when he said, when the soldier came in and said, do the orders still stand? That was a stand down order. Because, needless to say, the airspace around Washington, D.C., not only is it restricted, and the Pentagon was the most protected building in the entire world, and it had at least three, if not four, levels and layers of security around it. So what do you think Dick Cheney had ordered? Well, we already know from someone that contacted us that at least a couple of those security levels had been turned off. So how can the most protected building in the entire world, the United States Pentagon, have their airspace violated? Well, they have Patriot missiles and all kinds of stuff all around that building, always have. And so, you know, on 9/11, we all took a little mental vacation. We were so traumatized, we stopped thinking. Even me, I did too. I was like, how did that happen? That's the Pentagon. Because you just know, I mean, it's restricted airspace. Every once in a while, we would hear of someone in a small aircraft violating that airspace around Washington, D.C., or around the White House. And when it's restricted airspace, basically, it's seriously restricted around Washington, D.C., and it was at the time of 9/11.
Well, I think maybe one of the best examples of this is an air traffic controller who said that, you know, the radar is so good in that area that you can see up a sparrow's butt all the way to Kentucky. So it's not like they didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, that's true. And so if you have primary radar incoming, 1 minute, and boom, the Pentagon is hit 1 minute later. And guess what the primary radar is? Missiles don't carry transponders. And so anyway, I hope that time has just flown. I could sit here and talk for another hour. I hope that you understand that our common strategy really was to delay, and so that the pilots could coordinate with the ground people and air traffic control.
Why don't you just mention, you talk about recurrent training. How much of your annual recurrent training was involved in hijacking protocols every year? 10%,
20%, 100%. Oh, gosh. It was broken up into segments. And we did first aid. We did evacuations. We did, and every year was a little bit different. I would say probably at least 25% of our yearly recurring training, we would go over the protocols, the step-by-step, the code words, what to do, how to do it, what was the most important. And we'd
would you role play it?
We would role play, and we also had some years we would have FAA or FBI individuals come, and sometimes they would just send us a video, and then we would go over in that video. Sometimes they had changed over the years. I mean, come on, I flew for a long time since people were wearing girdles and false eyelashes. So, they would teach us all kinds of stuff about, a rifle or a gun, what kind of gun, what kind of pistol it was, and, how to recognize if it was a real bomb or a fake, things to look for, that kind of stuff.
So you can't say that any flight attendant maybe didn't understand what it was they were supposed to do.
No. There's no...
With regards to the common strategy.
No. The common strategy was the same for a long, long time, and it just hadn't changed at all. So if you'd been flying even 6 months, you knew what to do. And we were all trained to do the same thing. So, like, if I got on a different carrier and there was a hijacking, I knew exactly what the code words were. I knew everything that was going to happen. So the name of the game, get the airplane on the ground where the aircraft can be liberated by some hostage rescue team. Remember, Flight 11 had a hostage rescue guy on board, 9B, from Israelis. Yeah, how convenient was that?
Very.
Daniel Lewin. Somebody had asked me about that. Darn, I forgot to write that question down. They asked me, where do I think he is? That's a good question. I've asked myself that many times, actually, and not just about 9B, Daniel Lewin, but about several others that I've actually discovered their involvement. And yes, it'll come out in the third book.
At least what you think.
Some of it, yeah. All the indications indicating. I'm assuming, and it's hard to say. You work for somebody that would do something like this. I mean, he was Sayeret Metcalf. Bibi Netanyahu and Ehud Barak were Sayeret Metcalf. That's like the super CIA Jack Bauer of the Mossad. So they were hostage rescue specialists, and they did a lot of that sort of thing. It's hard to say. I mean, if you work for somebody like that, that could kill that many people just to get all these words going, would they shoot you in the head? It's hard to say. I wouldn't trust him. I hope he was smart enough to just get away. But yeah, that's a good question. Where is he now? Hopefully he stays out of our country. He's probably
didn't
basking.
Get a Christmas card from him this year, did
we? No, I didn't get one from Bush or Cheney either. But anyway, we just have just a minute left, and I just want to touch on this. If you are willing to send a methodical illusion to Donald Trump, we will send you a free book. Just contact me, email, and we will send you a free book and an address where you can send it to him. And you can put a note in there. We just want him to read the State of the Union address and be Joel Sherman. Thousands of us want that. So anyway, thanks for joining us. Hope you enjoyed your common strategy lesson.
I'll see if I can drag Sinatra out of the bar and have him say goodbye to us.
All right. Well, okay, Frank.
Come fly with me. Let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me. Let's fly away.